And Theo, I wanted to talk about the collaboration process that goes into creating a theater and your perspective as a designer, and just walk me through what typically happens with a client, if there's a typical process that happens.
Usually we get the projects that we get in one of two ways. We either get them directly from the client that read about us in a magazine and called us, or we get from an audio video integrator. Getting them directly for the client is usually the most satisfying, because either they've done the homework or they realize that we are the ones that do it, professionally, and they're usually more amenable to do it the way I suggest that we do. And I'll tell you how I deal with them. The other one is when we work with custom installers, when they bring the project. And I always try to make a point that even if the job comes from the custom installers, I would like to have direct feedback from the client. Because sometimes audio video integrators, they don't want to lose the connection with the client. They don't want to get a third party, even if the client asks for us, or even if they are the audio video integrator thought of us. They want to have control of the client. So I always make a point, and that's the point I make here. You need to have direct access to the client. You have to get feedback from the client. Otherwise, you design in absentia. You don't know what the client wants. You have to interview the client. So it starts with sitting down with the client and kind of communicating your enthusiasm about the space to them and making them feel that you're not selling them something. You just bring them into your world, because your world is a world that's immersed in home theater architecture, and you want them to be part of my excitement about it, so I can communicate my ideas to them and make them relax so that they can listen to me. Because if they have their own ideas, I get very defensive in a way that don't tell me what to do. And it's a wrong approach, because they're the client, they call the shots. But if they call me, I feel like they should listen to me. And I usually start the process after I have connect with the client, after he and I are on the same page. Once our vision, aligns, then I start the work. How does it start? How do you make your vision align? Early on in my career, the inspiration was a particular theater style. The client would say, hey, I want an Art Deco theater because I've seen your theaters and I like that style. It's cinematic. And I would usually go and say, yes, I love Art Deco. Let's do an Art Deco theater. And after a few years, when I saw an Art Deco theater happening in a very traditional environment, I started feeling a little bit embarrassed. It's like I was planting Disneyland in a house that was not Disneyland. It was real, traditional deco. It was the style of the house. It's like when you go to Epcot Center and you go into the Parisian pavilion or the French pavilion, the Spanish pavilion, it had that kind of phoniness, the concept of putting an Art Deco theater in a house that's contemporary just because the client liked. So I started putting in a gentle way my foot down, and I started directing the attention of the client to the fact that the theater should kind of echo the identity of the rest of the house, not imitate it. You don't want the theater to look like a living room or a dining room or whatever. You want it to look like a theater, but within the same language. Like you have the same language, but a different dialect that comes across as something else. And this has been one of the key elements of bonding with the client, making them trust me, making them feel that I'm not giving them what they want, not because I'm putting my foot down, I try to play the prima donna, but because I have the best interest in mind. I told them, I said it again a lot of times to people, I don't want to give you a theater where some of your guests when they see they're going to go, ooh and ah. But the other half or more sophisticated guests will say, what the hell is this theater doing in this house? It's different. I always seek approval, not only from the client, but the potential guest that might be more sophisticated with the client. Mm-hmm. That I protect my ass. From being accused as a gimmicky guy.
I could be completely wrong about this, but is part of this almost having to be like a psychologist and get a sense, make the theater, because the house is an extension of the personality of the owners. So yes, you want the theater to jive with that. So essentially you need to get to know who these people are instead of just making it a knee-jerk reaction to taste, right?
No, absolutely. You have to know them. And then the next step, first is to know what the taste are. The next step is to make sure that you guide them to things that they may have not thought of. They may know what they like. And what they like may be perfectly legitimate, and you go with it. But if I sense that I can guide them to get something beyond what they like, that would potentially like just as much, I feel that I protect my integrity, but I also protect the client from something that could be a liability if I give them something crazy. And I have so many examples with clients that actually taught me how important it is to listen to the client, and how you react or how you don't react is part of knowing the landscape and getting to know the client. I think I told you I was doing a theater for a client, well-known baseball player. I met with his wife somewhere in Georgia. It wasn't Atlanta. Don't publish the name because I'll describe the lady that came in, made up in a way that make Tammy Faye Baker's makeup demure. It was a lot. Huge eyelashes, painted lips, just big bouffant hairdo. She was a caricature of Nuvori's wife. So I interviewed her to find out what exactly she liked. And it was very, very, very ornate and all that kind of stuff that ladies of the South associate with an expression of they've made it, they've arrived. So I said exactly what I want the theater with, a lot of gold. I remember what it says, a lot of gold. That took a step back because I was I was surprised. And I said, you mean you want an opulent theater? I tried to put a little bit of more less. It says, I remember what it says, no, honey, I want it gaudy. Good for her. She knew what she was looking for. No, honey, says, I want it gaudy. Opulent, a good expression. So you can fight that person. You cannot persuade her because she has a gaudy house to do something that's more understated, because you fight against the grain. And you listen to them, and 90% of the time they make sense. You know what they want and they can express, and you help them. There are two or three times where you really hit the block and you don't know what to do. Like the other house in Jupiter Island, I saw the lady, and it was a fairly traditional, but not particularly gaudy. It was just like typical Floridian, richness, material. So I saw the space at the theater, and I knew that I didn't need to ask her what the style was. I knew I should have kind of echoed the style, but you ask her to break the ice and make her feel, but the process of interviewing the client, how to deal with the client, make her feel that it was a choice. I said, do you have a particular style? Do you know what you want for the theater? Yes, she said, she jumped up. I said, what do you want? We want the Acropolis. I almost swallowed my tongue. The Acropolis. I want to tell her we don't do Acropolis, but I just lost my train of thought. I said, Acropolis, what do you mean? She said, literally, she said, I mean, like the Versailles. Like the Versailles. She didn't even know how to say Versailles. Now, what the Acropolis had to do with Versailles, your guess is as good as mine. So I decided there's no way that I can do something there.
Have you ever had a case where somebody came to you with a perfectly good concept, something you could have run with, but you knew that something different was the better way to go? even though what they presented was you could have done it and you could have been happy with it, but you had something that you knew they would be happier with in the long run.
Usually, I don't think that ever happened. What I usually do, I crank up the volume. They come with some kind of a lame concept that's on the right direction, but it's not full-fledged. And my role is to kind of get started from the concept and improve it, enhance it, and make it more exciting than the original concept without turning their, starting from their concept. We want a standard theater, a typical example. They have a traditional house, they want traditional theater. Nothing wrong about it. What I usually find that I react negatively is when they start telling me that they want a comfortable sitting layout. We don't want anything like structures. We want a sofa here and an armchair there and an ottoman there. That I take offense. And I'm trying to be very restrained because it's their choice. I mean, that's how they watch movies. Mm-hmm. So I make an effort to educate them that if you do that, you're getting a living room in the guise of a theater. You have all the accoutrements of a theater, but it's literally a living room. And the classic example of that, and I didn't win, was the theater in Vegas that we saw together. Mm-hmm. You know, the big one with the tall ceilings that
the Americans with the chandelier.
Chandelier. Yeah. Forget the chandelier. I airbrushed it, but I couldn't persuade her to do something that was more theatrical. That was a very well-defined theater that focused on the screen, the stage, and everything. And she put sofas and living rooms. That's why I photographed from the balcony, cutting off the sitting arrangement. But this is a typical contradiction that I have with the client. They want a comfortable space. They want a theater, and but also a comfortable sitting. And I can't reconcile the two, Mark. I can try to tell them that there is nothing like structured seating that indicates a theater, signifies a theater. So I said, by not doing that, you have one foot in your living room and the other foot in my theater language. And the two don't coincide.
This is a little bit of a digression, but I think it's key to what you do that you create an experience that's separate from day-to-day living. Right? Mm-hmm. You go in there, the door closes, and you have to feel like you've been transported. So you absolutely don't want elements in there that violate.
No, that's absolutely. Yeah, that's what it is. And that's what I try to make them understand, that the concept that they have belongs to the living room. And the people that usually get my theaters do have a living room and do have a media room. And I try to tell them, we can do that in the media room, which makes sense. But let the theater be more a theater with comfy seats, spread apart, you know, with big armrests. You kick in, you kick up your legs because it's a recliner, and you still have the comfort of a living room. If you can have the comfort of a sofa, and even better with a seat, why do you want to have discarded furniture all over the place, which are not as comfortable? When I go down to my theater and I recline, it's ideal. You see the movie, you have good sight lines, you don't lose that luxury of a theater where it's meant to watch a movie with people in front of you, people behind you, not facing each other in a position that's meant for chit-chatting, not for watching a movie. So I find my reaction, my primal reaction to this casual seating is because it's meant to accommodate unruly owners that want to talk to each other while the movie is playing. Probably deep down, I react that dispersion of attention. That, I mean, when someone comes to my theater and start talking, I stop them. Don't talk. Let's watch a movie. As polite as I can. But having seating facing each other, it invites that kind of interaction with one another rather than us and the movie. So that's, I would say, my main argument with clients. When they want casual sitting, I try to persuade them to do. Do I always win? 90% of the time.
You get the most reluctance when you want to do something that's very contemporary and very stripped down. Do people associate movie watching with having decorative tech spaces?
Not really.
Okay.
There are people that want to have the movie experience without reference or the grandeur, or without the reference to the old movie palaces. I have been my holy grail, how to create the kind of excitement, architectural excitement, in a room that is expressed using contemporary architecture. It's very difficult because our mind is filled with images of palaces, with ornateness and chandeliers and everything. And that creates the ambience of wanting to see a movie inside the environment. Can you create that kind of ambience by using a more contemporary language? It's very difficult because contemporary architecture by nature more stripped down. But I believe I found out that you can achieve it mostly with architecture that's combined with lighting. Mm-hmm. Lighting brings that excitement. Just add lighting to a room, not sconces on the wall, not
like strip lighting, right?
But some strip lighting or columns that have backlighting or something. And you, lighting brings the architecture to the level of.
So theatrical lighting as opposed to practical.
Yes, lighting. Yes. Yeah. Instead of practical lighting, exactly.
Yeah. As far as the team that has to come together on a theater, one, how often do you find yourself collecting those people? And no matter what the circumstance is, how does that process work as far as, how often do you act as liaison between client and the rest of the people working on a project?
Usually for the big projects, I bring the people. And meaning about, talking about people, I mean, acoustic designers, lighting designers, not interior designers. Interior designers, I usually do it myself, but that's what it is. Acoustical designers, acousticians, and lighting designers are the people that I usually invite in big projects that require a more specialized knowledge of the craft, more specialized knowledge of what acoustic treatments go where, more specialized knowledge of what type of new lighting will illuminate that particular object that you may not know about it. Mm-hmm. And if I do know about it, it will be after extensive research, and I don't want to do it. In the movies, you get specialties to do. And I always say, use the example, making a theater is like making a movie. You have the sound designer in the movie or the sound recording, which is our acoustician. You have the director of photography, which is your lighting designer, knows how to illuminate the thing. You have the interior designer, which is decorator. In most cases, it's me. So you get a crew that works together synergistically to divide the elements of the theater in their particular expertises. So I bring these people. Very rarely I've run into projects where I work with the lighting designer of the house. I did it once with a lighting designer in Salt Lake City that was very good. I had a couple of books, I forget his name, and worked very well together. But I usually bring Howard Werner, who does my lighting for the project. Howard is a lighting designer on Broadway. He did Spider-Man. His famous thing was Spider-Man with Julie Taymor. Mm-hmm. Jules Fisher or, names like that, but he was good. So I have him there. And of course, I ended up working very extensively with Steve Haas because he knows my ways and he's compromising in the same way that I'm compromising to accommodate the acoustics. And when you work with trades like that, you have to respect each other's trades.
I would imagine it varies a lot, but if somebody's got certain expectations for the equipment they want, there's something there, the projector they want to try, a certain screen size they want, certain speakers they want to do, certain speaker configuration, how does that enter into your design process?
If the job comes from an integrator, I ask immediately to get a list of equipment and placement of speakers. So I design around what they have and where they position on the wall. I totally respect the science of someone that has to put a speaker exactly to the left and the right of the ear or the subwoofer to that location. I try to work around them. So I'm very accommodating. And sometimes you have to go back to them and says that doesn't work, like the project I worked in Texas. Put the subwoofers all the way to the floor but I have a 6-inch or 8-inch baseboard. And they ignored it and they put this woofer all the way to the floor. I said, come on, guys, lift the woofer for 6 inches. Will it create havoc? We're going to ruin the room acoustics. So I faced that issue yesterday and I told them, lift the damn speakers. I gave you a room that's 80% transparent, 90% transparent, to put the speakers wherever you want. The whole room is stretched fabric. It's a little bit more intricate than that. So you can put the speaker here and there or there, up or down. Give me a little room to put baseboard. Otherwise, the people will go down the steps and they will kick the fabric. You have a baseboard for a particular reason, to avoid kicking the fabric, and especially kicking the subwoofer if it has behind the fabric. So this is the kind of give and take that I have. But I start with their optimal position of speakers.
Have you ever had a situation where a client had expectations of things they want to do with equipment that just were not going to work and you had to steer them someplace else? Like they wanted a screen that was completely inappropriate, the size or whatever.
Screen is easy to win them over. Screen is easy. I tell them, usually it's very hard to accommodate in a low ceiling room that has at least 3 rows, a 16x9 screen. In order to have a big screen to fill the room, that screen goes all the way to the floor and you cannot see from head to head. So I have a very standard spiel, the speech to the client, use a widescreen because it fills the room with wise, but it doesn't go all the way down. And they usually buy it. I said, buy a big screen. Watch a movie like Lords of Arabia without bars, top and bottom. Most of the epics that people watch are widescreen movies. Mm-hmm. And move this picture inside the big screen if you want to watch 16x9. Now, I've had people that said, we don't watch movies, we want sports. These guys are meant for 16x9 screen. And then I work around a smaller size. But if I have my way, I get the widescreen because you get a bigger screen in a smaller space. But the client usually doesn't have strong objections about the screen. They may want something, but usually I influence them very easily because I know what works. I use a typical example for a widescreen. I said, if you like epic movies, you have to have a big screen. You cannot watch a screen, a 16x9 screen, when you project Lawrence of Arabia with black, the picture is smaller than when you project, dude, where is my car? You can't do that to Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah.
That's always an argument that wins them. And I get that. So,
have you had a situation now that video displays are approaching the size of projection screens and there are video panel walls, you can essentially come up with your own screen size. Have you had to start dealing with video displays in home theaters?
Not yet, because they're very expensive. As the price will go down, to get a good video display, it's going to be $300,000-$400,000 right now. Maybe they've gotten a little bit down. But the reason we don't have it, it's still a matter of cost.
Okay. Do you have any feelings about that one way or the other?
No, I believe that a nicely calibrated set will give you the same picture, and probably an advantage is you're going to get a brighter picture than you
get. Absolutely.
That is like I watch 3D movies downstairs and they suffer. The brightness, although it's a bright projector, it goes down. You're not going to have the problem with the brightness or of a display, or you're going to need a $200,000 projector to project a movie so bright that it just allows you to watch 3D movies without, looking at a dark picture.
One of the key things to your approach is you like to create a sense of anticipation. You don't want people just walking right into a room. How do you usually present that? Do people tend to grasp it right away? Have you had people just reject it flat out? They're not going there.
Nobody has rejected because I use a bring in memories or situations from going to the theater. He said, do you ever imagine, you build a theater in your house, right, in effect, in a house. Do you ever imagine going to a real movie theater? You open the door on the sidewalk and you find yourself in the room. It doesn't happen. Why? Because it's like riding a submarine. Before you go up in the water, you have to go through various compartments of decompression before you go to the very top. So you need to go from a small place to a larger space, to a larger space, to an even larger space. And I usually always bring into the picture the Roxy, for example. The Roxy had an incredible corridor with posters right on 50th Street and 7th Avenue. And that was like 10 feet high. And then from that, you would get to the ticket lobby, which was grander. It was like 15 feet high. And you got double the height. And you got the tickets. You started feeling that you got close to the theater. Once you pass this thing, you were down into a tunnel, practically, that led to the grand. That was 8 feet or 9 feet. And that led to the Grand Rotunda, which zoom up to 70 feet high. And you felt like, it's like an orchestral piece. You orchestrate the crescendos and the pianissimos to create variation and a sense of anticipation and a sense of excitement when something big happens. You can have something big happen. You can have a symphony that the crescendo of the piece happens at the very beginning and stays there. You don't. So I use the symphony example. You start, I don't know the musical terms, but you know, you orchestrate the piece, you write the piece so there are, it's slowly. I use exactly in the past as an example, Ravel's Bolero that builds up and builds up and builds up. That's how I see the theater approach. And the client, I want, even if you have the smallest space in the world, let me subdivide it. I'm not taking away from the space. I'm giving you a more nuanced approach to the theater, and usually the bite. I haven't met anybody that says no unless they don't have the space. My example usually to them is like, you don't want to walk down a corridor in your house, leave the kitchen, leave the bathroom, and then open a door and find yourself in a theater. You do that when you open the door and you want to find it in your bedroom. The theater requires some anticipation, some preparation, some psychological, you know, preparation in order to get into the room. And you need that you go in there. And I never lose that battle. If there is a space, we do it. If there is no space.
Well, remember Eric von Grimmenstein in Indianapolis? You helped him design, layout his theater in his basement. He's the guy who built his own stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I was astonished by how much he was able to cram into that without making it feel forced.
You know, no, it's a trick.
Reception area and everything. The way everything was folded in and the way you were essentially snaked through there was...
I remember the theater beautiful. That I did. It's in the book. If you have a copy of Great Escapes, look at the Ritz. He gave me the whole attic, which is a big space, 2,000 square feet. And says, how many seats can we fit in here? I have a big space and a big family. He says, wrong question. It's not how many seats. How do you create a theater environment? The seats is the final arrival. But let me do this. So I create a layout that was like a maze that was opening up. And the theater ended up right next to the entry, to the left of the entry. But you have to go all the way to the back and sneak around and go through inner lobbies, big lobby and grand foyer, and then to a smoking room, and then two corridors that finally, breathlessly, you arrive at the theater. And that's just like what Disney does when they do the theme rides, where they have you wait in line for 2 hours and watching different things on TV, or you go from one room to another before you go into the exhibit. They prepare you. That is not done mostly to showcase the architecture of the anticipation rooms. It's mostly to create a sense of anticipation, which is what I do by trying to capture the grandeur of arriving Roxy into a simple theater, which is what the cartoon that you sent me accomplished so well. For every space that you go, you get a ticket and it cuts down in half before you go into the auditorium. Yeah. That's exactly what is my principle and my philosophy, if I have the space to get to the main auditorium. I bet anybody that told me that I don't want to do that. That hasn't happened.
Anything else about the process of working with a client that we haven't covered that we should talk about?
Well, usually the client, I stop talking to the client while I work with the architect and the contractor. And when the construction is, you know, underway, then I meet with the client to select finishes. That's a very important part of the job because usually there's a designer in attendance, a designer that doesn't want to have the theater to be too far away from what she's doing in the rest of the house. And as a courtesy, I usually invite the designer and I talk to them and I tell them what the, you cannot use bright colors in the theater. You cannot use a carpet that jumped out on the floor because it makes the seats prominent. The seats is probably the most damaging element in the theater because they're large. And everything else that I do is kind of miniaturized to create a sense of scale. So you throw this the seats there and the three seats throw my work off proportion, which is the most typical example, horrible example, is the theater I did, which had a double problem. It was a recreation of the Miami Beach, the hotels, big, large scale,
six feet high. Yeah, all the deco, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then you see the seat that is as big as the building and you say right away, that's fake. Your sense of disbelief is eliminated and you suddenly see the artifact. That's all miniatures to create an effect.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was watching a documentary at Netflix with Fran Lebowitz. Did you see it? The one that Martin Scorsese directed? Fantastic. It's called New York. It's about walking in New York, the rudeness of New Yorkers and everything. And she, the key point is she sits in the miniature Manhattan in Queens, you know, they built a replica of Manhattan, the city of New York. And of course, when you see that city from it, it's amazingly. And then she steps into the set and her shoes are high as the some of the short buildings. And she becomes like, Gulliver and the Lilliputian, yeah. What do you call it? Yeah. So anyway, I try to avoid that as much as I can, but the seats are usually betrayed. So you have to balance the scale of the room with the scale of the seats. Don't go, you need to balance. There's not, it's just like making a recipe. You cannot put too much sugar because the thing will be too sweet.
Yeah.
You cannot put too much salt because that's a recipe that I know how to do it and I take pride in it. How did we start this?
One last question. Do you have any sense of how your approach might differ from how most other designers would approach an entertainment space?
I don't know because I haven't worked with other designers. All I know that, and can be a very generic observation, people that know but design theaters that they have a technical background, they start from the technology.
Mm-hmm.
And that is Sam Cavett and that's Keith Yates. They're very protective of technology and they should be. Designers are the opposite. They start by the interior design, how to make the look.
And they tend to be technology adverse, right?
Adverse, yeah.
Yeah.
I see myself as sitting in the middle between people that really don't pay lip service to the design. There's designers, acoustical or technical designers, and those that decorate. And I think if I were to put a label on what's my principal contribution to home theater design, is that I became a bridge between technology and design by respecting both things.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, to answer your question, I already did, but designers think about design. People that mostly are in technology deal with technology. That's how other people design it. That's how, as far as I can tell you, because I haven't watched them.
Okay, well, I don't want to play psychologist, but I think part of this is because you came to this through movie collecting and building your own systems, you understood how essential that is and you're aware of the technology, but then you realize proportionally how it has to fit in to the overall experience.
Yes.
A lot of people don't have that entry point.
I would make myself less heroic because that sounds like I discovered something. I would say that at some point when people got involved, like technical guys from Steve to people, integrators, I had to start listening to them. I didn't want to because I wanted to decorate at the beginning, but slowly I realized it's not just decoration. And that happened through pressure from people. We cannot put that speaker too far behind the seats. We want it here. So you had to kind of work around what the integrator or the client that was sound savvy. And then I started paying attention to material. You cannot make a theater like I did for, which was all wood with some token panels. It looked fantastic. It will look great, but it's very, it reverberates. So I learned to use materials that are not reflective, not only in terms of substance, material, but in terms of color. If you have a white surface, it reflects too much color off the screen. It makes you be aware that you're in the room. You want the room to disappear. The extreme case of the room disappear is Joe Kane.
Right.
You know Joe Kane.
Oh, sure.
He doesn't want to have anything other than a black room. And this is going the other extreme. You have a room that's very bright and colorful, and that's one extreme black room. There's got to be a middle ground sifting towards Joe Kane's view, where the room can look attractive when it's on, but it disappears, like my room downstairs. I can change the hues of the walls because I have the LEDs, and the room has a different personality if you come in. But when the movie begins, the room disappears, like a Joe Kane room. So everything can be done if you have tricks of the trade up your sleeve. And I've developed them by making mistakes and figuring out what works, what doesn't work.
Okay, I covered everything I wanted to. Are we good?
Okay. Fine, yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to stop recording.
Yes.
Okay, thank you for your...